In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Remember when Obama said he wasn't going to make coal illegal? He was just going to make it so expensive and punitive that you wouldn't dare to use it. Want to build a coal power plant? Sure, you can build that. But we're going to make it so expensive you can't afford it. And your little customers, too. It's about forcing change, not change you want. Because if you did, they wouldn't need to force it. It's change they want. Hence the need for force. It's a bit like that right now with policing. They are making conditions so bad that police retire early, and the few people you can hire cost more just to entice them to join the police. Then they'll sue you every step of the way and make it so onerous to be a policeman that no one will want to stay a policeman. In the same way, Governor Kate, who clearly suffers from some sort of mental disease causing her to hate the people of Oregon that she governs, her lockdowns open you to massive fines if you dare to stay open. Or don't follow silly rules like you can't eat inside a restaurant, but you can eat inside a tent that is outside the restaurant. Or allow people freedom of choice over whether or not to wear masks. Today, we'll be talking about defending freedom, especially here in Oregon. We'll talk about the latest shutdown, but also some odd developments in the legislature, in particular some Republicans who are normally staunch defenders of the Second Amendment suddenly cave. What's up with that? And not just that, but they gave up a tool that was successfully slowing down bad legislation. We'll talk about all of that with Rob Taylor. You know, at a time when you need your politicians to defend you, it is beyond disheartening when they bail on you. Not a good start for new leadership, because leading the retreat is not leadership. If you're at the front of a retreat, it means you're the first out the door while the people who follow you are the closest to the attack. It should be the other way around, leading the attack, putting you between the danger and the people who follow you. That's leadership. But first up, we're going to talk policing. As I said, police are under assault all across America, certainly no less than here in Portland. If it looks like a coordinated attack on law enforcement, it just might be, because it is, and led by none other than Obama. There's a new book out, The Obama Gang, How Barack Obama, through his post-presidency foundation, assembled, launched, and wages the new assault on American law enforcement. I'd like to welcome the author of that book, Steve Pomper. He's a contributor to LifeZet, a retired Seattle police officer, and the author of four other books. Steve, it's great to talk to you.
Oh, great to be here. It's my pleasure.
So before we dive into your book and your topic, when and why did you retire from the Seattle Police Department?
Well, it got to the point that I wasn't able to do my job. And one of the things that had happened was I became old enough to, had enough time in to retire. And I even lasted about 6 months longer than that. You know, I thought to myself, the fact that if I didn't leave when I had the opportunity to leave, it was an insult to those who wanted to leave but couldn't. It was something like that, because it got to the point that I felt if I got involved in a controversial incident, there was no way that my department or the city would back me on that. Mm. And these days, you can see officers are risking not only their jobs, livelihood, but also their freedom as far as being prosecuted. And so that was one of the things I saw that it was kind of a writing on the wall kind of a thing. And it was just a decision that had to be made. And it wasn't an easy one. I loved police work, but they weren't letting us do it anymore. So it's hard to stay in an occupation where you can't do what you love to do.
Well, and when did you retire?
I retired in 2014.
Okay, so it's very recently. So, and man, it's gotten way worse since 2014.
Oh, it's crazy. And the thing is, obviously Seattle, Portland, we're kind of ahead of the curve, not for any good reasons in the United States as to, what's happening everywhere now, because, our cities have been, dealing with this for decades probably. And I remember I thought in Seattle after WTO in 1999 is about when I saw that it was really, really ramping up, the anti-police, onslaught that we were getting from our city councils and the mayors and them wanting to indoctrinate us in critical race theory is what they, you know, call it now. But back then, you know, it's just basically indoctrination of, you know, social justice kind of thing. And it was definitely time to make a decision after that. But that, I think 1999 is about when it really, there was like a little bit of a hump there. And then, after 9/11, we got some decent, you know, support from the public for a little while. And, you know, now we're back.
Hmm. Well, you mentioned it's gotten personally more dangerous for police. And, and one of the things that just recently happened was the New York City Council did away with qualified immunity for police officers, making it that much easier that they can be personally sued. And not that the police department indemnifies them anymore, but now you can directly go after police officer. I think it's just absolutely horrifying. Your book, The Obama Gang, was published just recently here a couple of weeks ago, published by the National Police Association. You know, a lot of times when you read a book, there's a disclaimer. This book doesn't necessarily reflect the views of the publisher, but I didn't see any such disclaimer. And to be clear, does that mean they officially endorse your assertion that Obama is using his foundation to wage war on law enforcement?
In this case, yeah, we're on the same page. They asked me to write the book, and what they do is they're very into educating people about what law enforcement does, even, you know, people in the conservative realm, so that they understand that some of the things are maybe not look good, but they can give the officers the benefit of the doubt and kind of do a little research at the National Police Association website to see why maybe an officer did something you don't understand what he did, you know, or what she did. And that way it kind of, it helps. As far as my wanting to do it is, I really saw it as a opportunity to push back. I think that's one thing conservatives really need to do, because so many of us, I know my wife's like this, she'd rather just kind of be quiet and not challenge, you know, people who are asserting things on the left. You know, she just, and I think a lot of good people on the right are doing that. And I think that we probably need to push back more often now, because we're not dealing with just political opponents. I think we're dealing with kind of a social cultural enemy. Now, they will really want to bring law enforcement down. They want to bring American traditional institutions down, and they want to change the American system a more socialist or even Marxist system.
Yes, and I think we'll get into that in more depth here in the next couple of segments. So that was a little bit of a rhetorical question, because I already knew, having read your book there, it says the NPA does, in fact, endorse this idea that Obama was waging war. They say this, quote, "The NPA noticed the anti-police faction seemed to be part of a larger family or gang of wealthy and radical individuals and organizations, with the former President Barack H. Obama at the top. They seem to operate similar to an organized crime family on the periphery of civil society." And I think he's right, or I think both you and the organization are right, is that this is a conspiracy, I think, here against America. You know, they want to transform America. So we'll talk about your book in more depth in a bit, but explain to our audience what evidence you have that directly indicated Obama is, in fact, behind the assault on law enforcement.
Well, for me personally, I got my first bit of evidence back in around 2010, 2011, when I was still active, and the DOJ came to town and implemented basically a consent decree on our department, which was, as far as I'm concerned, bogus. They came in, they looked at some incidents, and then they came up with numbers that were absolutely ridiculous, something like 20% of every interaction between officers and the public was a violation of constitutional rights. You know, I mean, something ridiculous like that. And they refused to release their methodology to, you know, what they were going on to implement this consent decree. It was interesting that a Seattle University professor who used to work for the DOJ, he was a criminal justice professor, wrote a special to the Seattle Times totally debunking their assertions using the same numbers they used, and basically told Seattle that they should demand an apology from the DOJ and send them packing. And, you know, unfortunately, the Seattle, you know, city council, the Seattle mayor didn't do that. That consent decree is still on today.
Pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. Okay, let's go and take a break there. More with Steve Pomper, author of The Obama Gang and The War on Police. Stay with us.
Hey,
And welcome back. We're talking with Steve Popper, a retired Seattle police officer and the author of five books, including his latest, The Obama Gang. It's now available on Amazon.com and wherever you buy books. It's about how Barack Obama assembled and launched and is behind the war on police. It is a very enjoyable book written in plain-spoken, straightforward, unpretentious language. I kind of liked it, likened it to sitting down for coffee with a cop and asking, so what's the real story behind the problems of law enforcement today? What's really going on? So, Steve, in this and the next segment, let's talk about what's really going on. What is it like to be a policeman in today's day and age?
You know, it's really tough because, you know, obviously there are different types of departments. There are still some good agencies to work for where you may even have certain members of the public against you, but you have a good sheriff or you have a good police chief. And, you know, things can work out for you as far as your law enforcement career. In fact, in places like Seattle, they've got a lot of officers that aren't just quitting the department or retiring. They're actually lateraling to other more cop-friendly departments. But for those of us in departments like Seattle or Portland, and frankly, I don't understand how the Portland police officers do it at all. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of days of you know, protests in a row or riots in a row. It's crazy. But when you're out there, it's really tough to go out there understanding that, you know, that they tell you there's a silent majority that supports you. And I think that that's true. But as long as they're silent, you don't really feel it. You know, you might, you know, bolster yourself on that, you know, assumption that there is. But what you're seeing when you're out there is you're seeing people that are, you know, yelling at you, coming down on you. I heard today that in Seattle schools, they're actually teaching, you know, kids to berate the police when they see them.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
And it's absolutely pathetic. And that's what, you know, a lot of the officers are going through. And then the decision making, hesitation in police work means you're putting yourself at risk.
Yes.
And every officer, how can you not think about what's happened? I mean, right now in my mind just popped up two officers that lost their jobs in my department for basically nothing. I mean, they were for doing their jobs. And, you know, every officer thinks of that. And they're getting, and so if you want to avoid that hesitation, you may decide, well, I'm not going to do this proactive policing that I might otherwise do. You know, obviously not when somebody's life is in jeopardy or something like that. But for something else where you might investigate a suspicious circumstance or even do a traffic stop or, you know, some infraction, jaywalking, you're not going to do it anymore because you know what that's going to turn into if somebody decides to resist you. And then it turns into police officer beats up jaywalker. So it's tough.
Well, it's crazy how the left is just out there undermining the very foundations of being a police officer. I mean, you mentioned earlier about the lack of support, and now they've removed the notion of qualified immunity. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's crazy that when you talk to police today, what do you hear from them in terms of at what point does it just become, I'm just walking away. I'm just walking away.
Yeah, there are a lot of factors that go into it. Obviously, the ones that are closer to retirement, they go ahead and just do that. I know two officers who recently actually retired earlier. They, you know, we get our full pension at a certain time, but you can retire so many years earlier and you have to wait before it kicks in where you actually start getting paid your pension. And these guys are choosing to get out and go do a different job until their pension kicks in 3 years later. That's how bad it's gotten. And also how new you are is a difference. I mean, I'm hearing now about recruits leaving the academy.
Yes.
After they go home and watch the news at night. And I've never heard that before because there's ways they're in a separate, you know, atmosphere, and they can kind of put that aside. But a lot of them now, and that's something new. I haven't heard that before.
Well, the the retirements is way up in New York City alone. Their retirements are up 75% compared to the year before. 75%. And mm-hmm. then also on the other side of things, you just don't have as many people going through the system at all. It was on Law Enforcement Today, I believe, that says that normally you'd get 15 to 20,000 new recruits. I think this is I think it was in Philadelphia, and they only got 2,000. I mean, that's astounding.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, there's an anecdote I have that just occurred. LinkedIn sent me an ad and said, you know, because of police officer, so they said you might be interested in this. And they showed a job. It was an entry-level police officer in the city of Seattle. And then a little note under it said, be the first to apply. And I noticed it had been up for 2 weeks. And even before I left, talking to our recruiters, I know one time they went to Orlando, I think it was, to a job fair, and they didn't have anybody come by their booth that was interested in being a police officer in Seattle. And that's a common thing. I don't even know if they, I mean, I know they have a recruiting unit still, but I don't know what they do. I don't know what kind of incentives. I know they're giving money now to try to get people to come, but that's not even working.
No, well, you know, the AP, Associated Press, just reported on Wednesday that 246 police officers have left the Seattle Police Department where you worked just over the last year. I mean, that's a reduction of nearly 20% of the police force. I mean, this is happening in big cities, though, all across America. That at what point is this truly dangerous for these cities, or are we already past that point?
Oh, we've pushed way past that point. I know when I came on the department, they were saying at that time, that was back in 1992, they were saying that we already had, we're below what we should have for our population. In fact, we had the same amount of officers that we had in the 70s with, I think, a 200,000 person increase. And of course, it's increased since then in Seattle. And they haven't increased. In fact, when they increased the last allotment of officers, they basically they could have 1,380 officers. Last I heard, official numbers they're putting out is 1,180. However, I know a guy who went to lunch with a sergeant, a still on duty sergeant, the other day, and I'm hearing now the numbers are under 950 officers that are deployable in Seattle for a city of over 700,000 people.
Wow.
So it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's very crazy. So let's talk a little bit about what's wrong with police. You know, no human organization is perfect because humans aren't perfect. If they were, you wouldn't need police to begin with, or organizations for that matter. You say law enforcement agencies are constantly striving to improve. So what are some areas where they recognize, you know, we just have some real shortcomings in these areas, and what are they doing to address those areas?
Yeah, I think that there's a real problem with the word reform. And I understand why Senator Scott used it in his bill, because otherwise he wasn't going to get Democrats on board at all. And so he could think a different definition of it than maybe they do. But reform is a tough thing for a country where you've got so many different agencies that police different types of communities. And there's no one thing that you can, you know, apply to every single department. Now, you can have certain departments and certain units here and there that, you know, become problems, and those may need to be reformed. However, most departments in general is a matter of improvement. And I know, as like in the Seattle Police Department, we were constantly looking for, as they call them, best practices and, you know, how to improve the department, improve policing, improve technology, and, you know, any other types of tactics, you know, and things like that. But it's at the point now that it's all reform, 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 and they throw it out there without any definition. You know, they just know they don't like the police, so you must reform. And I'm standing pretty adamantly against that. I just don't like that particular term, because it would be like saying, okay, well, let's go out and we got to reform restaurants. Let's reform restaurants,
yes,
because
exactly.
Right now the restaurants, well, the restaurants are all different.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and take a break there. I want to come back on that idea of reform and what exactly that means, because, you know, that's one of the things that you never hear them say is defining that. So we'll talk about reimagining policing with Steve Pomper after this. Steve Pomper is the author of the new book, The Obama Gang, How Barack Obama, Through His Post-Presidency Foundation, Assembled, Launched, and Wages, The New Assault on American Law Enforcement. You can find out more by heading to stevepomper.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-P-E-R.com. We'll put all of that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. And Steve, as you know, as people can imagine here in your book, it's awfully hard to track who's in and who's out and who's doing what in the war on police, which is a constantly moving target. You say this organized attack on police, this confederation of co-conspirators, even includes some convicted terrorists as members and directors. Can you share some of those with our audience, who they are and what they do?
Well, it's kind of interesting the depth that it goes into. Obviously, George Soros is at the top of this as far as the economic support that goes, and what that does is he's created such a web and fog of organizations that overlap. And, you know, I don't think that there's one organization that I researched that didn't almost immediately split into two or three. right from the beginning, and which obviously just, you know, just obscures where the money goes. But it's there, and it's going down to a lot of anti-police, groups, and coming after that. And, you know, as far as, you know, that Asada Shakur, have you heard of her at all? She's the woman, Deborah Chesimard, I think is what her other name is. And she's got some other aliases. And she's the one responsible for killing a trooper in New Jersey. Hmm. And she escaped from prison. And she's been, they believe she's been hiding, holed up in Cuba for years. I remember seeing, I think, a 60 Minutes documentary where it actually showed her down there. So I'm thinking she probably is. And they, at the East Precinct, when they created the Chop Chaz zone up in Seattle, which was the precinct I was at for over 20 years, they had her poster just emblazoned right on the side of the precinct throughout that whole thing. And she's an absolute hardcore Marxist, loved Castro. Castro protected her. And like I say, also a cop killer. And when you get into a lot of these folks that are, you know, running these organizations, you find these connections, and a lot of them have connections to, killing police officers, killing guards, explosives, you know, and now they've been rewarded with, professorships and various things like that. It's really tough to see when you see things like that, and yet they're absolutely ignored by the mainstream media, the connections.
Well, you know, you mentioned about all the organizations there, and that really rings a bell with me because back in the day when I was doing a lot of research on the environmental movement, that's exactly what they do. They've got all of these little side groups and main groups and funding groups, and you just can't track the money. It becomes blinding almost in terms of how many organizations are out there and where that money's going, from who to whom, and of course with, you know, a normal 501c3. You can only see so much. I mean, you see the top five contractors, and that's it.
There's actually a guy in Oregon. There's a guy in Oregon who actually did a little experiment. He was actually a left winger, and he was looking to give some money to BLM. So he went to the site, and he thought, "Well, I'm going to do a nominal donation of $1 just to see, so I can track it and see where it's going." And he said, after he'd done that, he got information back that said that, thank you for your contribution to Act Blue. And he's wondering, well, what is Act Blue? And then you start to dig a little bit deeper, and you find out that that's one of those other organizations that, because BLM was not tax exempt, they found a tax exempt organization to send the money to. The thing is, this guy, he said, he was looking to just give some money to Black Lives Matter as an organization. He wasn't interested in giving to the Democratic Party or to any other causes. And yet he found that he was being channeled or funneled into somewhere he didn't want to go. Mm-hmm. And yet you don't hear any investigations of these folks.
No, and it's pretty crazy. And that does need to be investigated. Getting back to your book, does Obama actually know and approve of the actions of these underlings? In other words, are they being actively directed by Obama, or are they just merely allies with aligned interests, and he's just, you know, basically a talking figurehead while the minions go off and do whatever it is they want without operational control?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think that you're seeing that also with the lawyers, a lot of commentary about, you know, Obama sitting behind the curtain of the Biden administration. But you hear, you know, from the comments ever since Cambridge and the stupid police acted stupidly. And, even with John Lewis's recent funeral, where he accused the police of using batons against peaceful protesters. I mean, that's very incendiary for us when we hear that kind of thing, because the cops don't use force against protesters. They use force against rioters. You know, and then about Michael Brown's situation, he went to a town meeting after that and said, even though his DOJ had cleared Darren Wilson, he said, perhaps we'll never know what happened.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so he's behind like that. And then, of course, with the Obama Foundation, he's got the Reimagining Police Pledge, where he's got over 300 mayors, 10 of the biggest cities, basically swearing allegiance to him and promising that they're going to review the use of force policies and talk to the public about what police are doing, report back to him, and then reform use of force policies. It doesn't say anything about, well, if we find something wrong, we're going to go ahead and reform the policies. It's just, we're going to reform the policies. And missing from the whole conversation, they don't talk to the police.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yep. So in terms of reimagining policing, Obama, before and after he was president, routinely bashes the police. He was president for 8 years, and like race relations, he could have made things better, but didn't. His foundation is sitting on $139 million in yearly revenues and another $400 million of assets. So with all of his millions and access to tens of millions more through state and federal grants that he could go after, has Obama and the rest of the family created the ideal police force anywhere in America that they can point to and say, we did this, look how great it's running?
No, not at all. Everywhere they've been, policing is worse. It's interesting how we used to say, you know, they talk about systemic racism, and it's interesting, at least in Seattle, the conservatives or Republicans haven't been in control for decades. You know, they're the system. If there's systemic racism, they're the system. And so it's kind of interesting to build this into us against them when they're the ones that have been in control for all this time. And everywhere that I mean, Obama, he put consent decrees, his DOJ, on, I think, nearly two dozen police departments. And we're seeing now, only, what, 3-4 months into Biden's presidency, he's already starting, and he's got two down, and he's just going to keep going. Anywhere there's a news story about something that he doesn't like, we're going to see consent decrees come down again to federalize, basically, local law enforcement.
And that's been my concern. In fact, I think I'd like to have you back sometime to talk specifically about that, because it looks to me like this is typical socialism. They create the problem and then miraculously appear with the answer to stop the pain that they are causing.
Just
one last question here. If Obama is behind an organized effort to destroy policing as we know it, what, if anything, can be done about it? I mean, aren't there any good prosecutors out there that would want to take him down, you know, that way that we've seen an endless stream of prosecutors going after Trump on any number of things?
You know, I hope. I don't know where the prosecutors are. I don't know where the judges are. You know, it's just really getting to me that even with, like, for instance, Rudy Giuliani getting, you know, basically invaded by the FBI. Where are the whistleblowers in the FBI? What officer or what agents are doing that? I mean, it seems so obvious to me that if I were an agent, I don't know, that's about time to leave the agency or to come out against it. You know, it's just getting to me that that they don't have people. And that's why I think pushback, even at the lowest levels, is so important. And pushback can be as easy as, you know, talking to somebody who's got a different opinion, just giving them your point of view. So ask them a few questions about what they believe, or write a letter to the editor, go to your, you know, school board meeting. It can be that minimal.
Being silent never solves anything. We're definitely going to have you back. Steve Popper, author of the book, The Obama Gang. Steve, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure.
iSpy Radio is proud to be part of the lineup on KWRO, airing out of Coos Bay, airing Saturdays 7 to 8 p.m., but on Mondays on KWRO, 3 to 6 p.m., you can catch the Rob Taylor Report. Rob is a longtime voice in the conservative grassroots and a huge Second Amendment advocate. Rob, it's great to talk to you.
Oh, it's good to be here. Glad to be with a fellow KWRO radio person.
That's right. So lots happening here in Oregon, at least if you're part of the government. But if you're a business owner or just a regular citizen hoping to scrape your life back together, the dictator-in-chief Kate Brown has decided she hasn't had enough supreme power yet, and so she has once again locked down most of the state. So, Rob, what are your thoughts on this?
I think it's ludicrous. If we look at what's going on in Florida and in Texas, and considering Texas has one of the lowest rates of people catching the disease and people dying, and they have no mask mandates down there, we should follow suit. It's ridiculous. We're going into the summer weather. Our immunity is being built up. The herd immunity is being sheltered, but is being spread all over the state. And the best way to do to get healthier and get moving again is for us to get outdoors and get active.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned that Texas doesn't have their mask mandates anymore. I am coming to believe that that's part of the problem. Everybody agrees on both sides of the aisle, you know, no matter what kind of doctor you are, that the COVID virus loves moisture. And so you're breathing in and out of these masks. You're creating a pool of moisture on the surface of that. Well, guess what? You just created a COVID sponge and you're breathing through it. So I think that the masks are complicating things for sure. So the new round of lockdowns are going to have a crushing impact on businesses. According to the Oregon hospitality industry, the state has already lost 1,185 food service businesses, not just jobs, the businesses themselves. Coos County is labeled high risk. You guys are surrounded by two moderate risk counties. What, if any, impacts are you seeing in your neck of the woods, and how are local politicians addressing this?
Well, our local politicians, they're AWOL, missing in action. They are not here to be defending us. And you talk about the restaurants going out. We're a small town of 3,300 people. We've got very few choices of eateries around here. And probably about three of them are never coming back. And that's out of six restaurants we have in town. We've lost a lot of our choice. People have lost their jobs, their livelihood. And the governor doesn't seem concerned one iota about what's going on out here on the South Coast.
And what about your county representatives? Because I know that a lot of county commissioners are lodging formal protests. Even the Association of Oregon Counties is taking a stand against this. Nothing at all out of the county commissioners?
Our county commissioners, one of them, Melissa Cribbins, is the president of the Association of Oregon Counties, and she has written letters. She's still pressing for it, but at this point in time, I think that the county should go even further and just declare an emergency, an economic emergency, and just completely ignore all of the mandates that the governor has put out as far as masking, distancing, and shutting down businesses.
Well, Yamhill has certainly taken that step. I know that Baker County is looking at doing something similar, so it would be nice to see politicians not just write letters, but actually do something. So we'll talk about the Republicans in more depth, meaning the legislative, they're the legislature. We'll talk about them in more depth because it looks like they have sold out over gun rights. So make sure that people stick around for that. But their one genuine tool to stand up to abuse of power is what we've seen in the past is to walk out and deny quorum, which stops everything. They have famously used it with the carbon emissions and cap and trade bill 2 years in a row, thanks to the support of Timber Unity. So imagine if Republicans had walked out on day one of the legislative session and declared, as long as Oregon businesses, churches, and schools are locked down, the legislature is going to remain closed, and then not come back until Governor Kate gave up her emergency powers and agreed to work with the legislature as intended in Oregon's Constitution. Can you imagine how different life in Oregon would be right now?
Oh, it would be completely. The ball would be in our court, and then we would be able to have a little bit of more authority. And the Republicans who stayed are just lying about the reasons they stayed, because we know that there was a big payoff now from the federal government, where senators get $4 million each to decide how to spend in their district, and the representatives get $2 million each to decide where they get to spend that money in their district. So this was a payola for our Republican representatives. A good portion of them sold out, not all of them, and we're stuck with the bill, and we're stuck with more regulations when we could have stopped it all.
Yeah, it's shocking. Plus, they would really have established themselves as heroes. And who knows, they might have even been able to convince a Democrat or two to go with them, like Betsy Johnson. So, all right, let's go and take a break. Here in Oregon, gun rights and the right to defend yourself are always under assault because idiot politicians never seem to understand that gun laws only punish law-abiding citizens, not criminals, because criminals don't obey laws. We'll try to make some sense of things coming up next with Rob Taylor. We're talking today to Rob Taylor, the host of the aptly named Rob Taylor Report, which airs on Mondays, 3 to 6 p.m. on KWRO in Coos Bay, one of the stations that also airs the iSpy radio show. Rob is a Second Amendment expert and has led the fight to create Second Amendment sanctuary sanctuary counties that a number of counties around Oregon have already passed. And Rob, so at least one onerous gun bill, SB 554, has passed and it easily passed in the House 34-24. Although in the Senate, it passed with a 16-7 vote, which means seven senators were conspicuously not voting, either absent or excused. This bill was about gun storage, allegedly, which I am sure every gun-toting criminal is very concerned about, right?
Right, of course.
Talk to us about the impact of this bill and why it's a bad bill.
Well, first off, it's not only a tax on law-abiding citizens, but it goes further to make us more defenseless, because the bill itself, SB 554, it was to keep people from going into public buildings with a concealed carry license. And then they added HB 2510, which gave a liability to anyone who didn't lock up their gun and had that gun stolen, anyone who commits a crime with that, you're liable for it for the next 2 years. So not only are they taxing us, because now we have to have our guns locked up in a safe. You have to buy a safe. You have to buy the locks for the guns. You have to have the locks on the guns while it's in the safe. So I don't know how you're supposed to protect yourself when you have home invasions, people kicking in their door, they're pointing your guns at you, and you're supposed to, what, take 5 minutes to go to your safe, unlock it, unlock the gun itself. And then on top of it, this, people don't understand that these gun safes, especially for long rifles, are very expensive, and that's the tax that they're imposing on us. And they also increase the fee for going to get a concealed carry license, a concealed handgun license, I should say. All of this is just adding to more laws that are going to deter not the criminals, but average citizens from being able to protect themselves and their families.
In terms of the storage end of this bill, does that apply to things like shotguns and normal hunting rifles?
Yes. All your guns will have to be locked up.
Wow. Pretty crazy. Are they planning on searching people's houses now to find out if they have gun locks on, or is that just a future bill?
Well, thank goodness we still have the Fourth Amendment, where you have the right to be secure in your house, and you have a right to due process. Well, for most cases, unless it's a red flag law, due process has been thrown out the window with that. But there is no way they're going to be able to enforce this until an actual crime happens. And then when the crime happens, you get robbed, your guns get stolen. They come in to investigate and say, well, you didn't have them locked up. You didn't have them in the safe. Now you are the criminal. So someone else's actions can actually make you a criminal in the eyes of the law.
So from an Oregon Firearms Federation article, it says that SB 554 will send Oregonians to prison for going to an airport, visiting their child's school, or daring to enter the Capitol building where Antifa and Black Lives Matter rioters are welcome. It will hold gun owners responsible for crimes committed with guns that were stolen from them and prohibit you from allowing your trained 17-year-old daughter from protecting herself when you're not at home. Could you elaborate on that last sentence? That's pretty astounding.
Well, yeah, they're expecting you not only, like I said, to be responsible for your gun, and beyond the point of responsibility, they're telling you to literally disarm your house by making sure that gun is locked up and secured away, because you can't even leave your gun for your 17-year-old. I know that there is some confusion with that. People are saying it allows you to leave access for your child, but in the law, if you read it very clearly, it says that you cannot have a gun being able to be accessed by anyone under the age of 18.
Wow.
Well, what if you have to leave and you've got your 17-year-old daughter at home and you've got to go to work? Doesn't she deserve the same protections that all the rest of us do? I would say yes.
Scary stuff. So speaking of some future bills there, what other gun bills are in the works?
Right now, they combined three. They combined the liability gun bill with the gun bill that would also stop you from taking your gun into any public buildings such as schools or colleges. I believe even hospitals are listed on that. But if you go further and you read the description of where you can't take your gun, it kind of leaves it open for municipalities, because it seems like they can make the local library a place where you couldn't even take your concealed carry license, according to the wording of the bill. It's very vague, and it leaves open lots of interpretation for this law.
Well, hopefully this will get struck down on appeal if somebody actually tries to challenge us. Let's go and take a break a little bit early. Rob has alluded to it earlier. Did the Republicans sell out on gun rights, literally? Well, according to a new article by the Oregon Firearms Federation, they sure did. We'll discuss that next with Rob Taylor. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now. We're talking with Rob Taylor. He's the host of the Rob Taylor Report, which airs Mondays 3 to 6 p.m. in Coos County on KWRO, which also streams live. And we're also proud to be on that station. So, Rob, have Republican legislators sold out, literally? Because according to Oregon Firearms Federation, they sure did. A lot of us, you know, really couldn't figure out why Republicans, who always hold themselves up as heroes and defenders of the Second Amendment, caved on SB Senate Bill 554, which we talked about earlier. There are two things at work here, though. The Republicans had been using a tool to gum up the works and stall the process by forcing a reading of the bills on the floor. But they agreed to give up that tool in exchange for equal representation on the Congressional Redistricting Committee. But in a scathing article titled, "Well, Now We Know," OFF accuses the Republicans of literally selling out on SB 554 in exchange for millions of dollars that they can personally decide how to dole out in their districts, circumventing the normal budgeting process. As you said, each senator gets to splash $4 million around their Senate district, and each House representative gets to dole out $2 million. What do you think of this? Was this truly a sellout or just merely coincidental timing?
Oh, it was a definite sellout because they knew that this was going to happen. They knew ahead of time that this money was coming down after the federal government had passed that bailout bill that 2.9 or $2.7 trillion that they're sending to counties. They are sending that money to counties that don't even exist. I was reading a report on that. That's how, you know, they're just spreading that money everywhere. So, you know, let's go back to that redistricting. The senators, one of the reasons six of the senators stayed and didn't walk out, and the reason those six senators stayed, part of that reason is because they, like you said, is that they wanted the House of Representatives, the Republicans in the House, to be able to have a little more say over the redistricting. But that's a lie because the Democrats have the final say on anything that comes out of that committee. So they have no choice. They have no decision-making power. So that's a ruse right there. So we really believe it goes back to the money. If they would have walked out, there's no way that the Democrats would have been more generous in giving them that money. In fact, I would say the only reason they're doing it this way, by spreading it out to each individual senators and the representatives, was to literally buy them out so that those Republican senators and representatives would stay in session so that they could pass more taxing bills, more gun bills. And you watch, by the end of it, they're going to be passing all kinds of new legislation. Critical race theory is going to be put into many of these different education bills. Already has. They're talking about the equity of students and the equity of education, the equity of healthcare. All of that garbage is going to be coming through. And the Republicans, if they haven't had the backbone to walk out now, they probably won't until the end of session. So the only thing we have as a recourse is to recall some of these Republican senators, especially the six that didn't walk, because if those Senate Republicans, all of them, all 12 of them, and Boquist isn't even a Republican now, and neither is Art Robinson, but they work with the Republicans. If all of them would have walked out, it would have ended this problem. Well, and like you said, they would have been able to negotiate and try to get the governor to stop the shutdowns.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about these recall efforts. I know that you've got one going against Girard. Are there active ones going against all of the senators that did not walk out, or just so far against Girard?
Well, as you know, anytime you do a recall, it's very difficult. It takes lots of money. And we would have enjoyed going after all six senators. Unfortunately, because of manpower and because of money, we're only going after the lead Republican senator for now. That may change in the next day. So I'm the treasurer of a political action committee that says take a walk. That's the name of our political action committee, because that's what they should have done. They should have taken a walk. And if they can't take a walk now, well, then they should take a walk and completely leave their position, because they don't have the backbone to protect the people's rights. And walking out is a legitimate recourse for bad legislation.
Sure.
And anyone who says different, then ask yourselves, why are the Democrats doing it in other states? There are Democrats who walk out all the time when they don't get what they want, and they use it as a bargaining chip.
Yeah,
There's no reason that our Republicans shouldn't have done the same.
Yep, exactly. And in fact, the Democrats have done that here in Oregon as well. So What is the process to recall a senator?
You have to file on the senator an SEL 350. It's a form it's a recall form. You send it into the Secretary of State. She sends you a template for the petitions, and then we get the signature gatherers all organized. We get them together, and they're out right now, currently gathering signatures. We did a mailer where we sent out a mailer to over 2,000, so far 2,000 Republicans in Fred Girard's district. And we're going after Fred Girard because he's the leader of the minority of the minority party in the Senate. So he's the leader of the Republicans in the Senate, and he should have led by walking out. And if anyone says, well, that's ridiculous, ask yourself this. Why did the six other senators walk out? If this wasn't a good, legitimate course of action, then why did six other senators walk out?
Yeah. Real quick here, how many signatures do you need for this to make it work?
9,000. And 9,000 legitimate signatures, and so 12,000 overall.
And then once you get those, does it go to the voters, the PCPs, like when someone retires or otherwise leaves office, or do commissioners just pick one?
He gets to decide whether he wants to resign, and if he doesn't resign, then we go to the voters. If the voters decide to have him recalled, and he's been recalled at the ballot box, I believe it's the PCPs, the precinct captains of the party in that district, get to pick the next person to go into the legislature. So we'll get another Republican. Hopefully the next Republican will be more of a leader.
Yes, and have gotten the message. Rob, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, not a problem. It was great. It went by quick.
It sure did. Be sure to join us next week. A really big show as we dive into the truth about COVID. We'll be interviewing our doctor, an expert witness who has testified in court about COVID. It's time for a little daylight disinfectant. There is a one-sentence Joint House Resolution HJR 18 in committee that reads, quote, be it resolved by the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon pursuant to ORS 401.204, the state of emergency declared by the governor in Executive Order 20-03 on March 8, 2020, relating to the COVID-19 outbreak in Oregon, is terminated. Wouldn't that be nice? Please contact all members of the House Committee and urge them to bring this bill to the floor. We'll have the emails up on iSpyRadio.com. You can certainly find that discussion on Facebook as well. If you can't take 10 minutes of your time to write a couple of sentences to a group of legislators, then I don't ever want to hear you complain again. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.